This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Rogue Queen by Emily R. King, performed by Lauren Ezzo and Scott Merriman. For Joseph, Julian, Danielle, and Ryan, your names are in my book front and center. Happy now? Love, Mom. Author's note. The religion of the Tarachand Empire, the Parijan faith, is a fictional variation derived from Sumerian deities. However, the Parijan faith and the Tarachand Empire and other empires do not directly represent any specific historical time period, creed, or union. Any other religious or governmental similarities are coincidental and do not depict actual people or events. 1. Kalinda. The burial starts at daybreak, before the heat of the jungle evaporates the dew and suffocates the morning breeze. Our solemn group congregates in the stern of the riverboat and watches Devon and Yatin finish tying heavy stones to the body's ankles and wrists. Inda has already washed the deceased in almond oil, a ritual in her homeland, the Southern Isles. Pons, her beloved guard, helped her wrap the departed with white bedsheets. Natasha slips her arm around my waist. I hold on to her, shifting my weight off my sore leg. Prince Oshwin stands to the side, his head down, but I can still see his red eyes and nose. Devon straightens slowly as though every part of him aches. I recognize that feeling, that sinking heaviness like quicksand. Everyone aboard moves with the same cumbersome slowness, as though we are all tied down by millstones. The rush of the River Ninsar fills the silence. If only life could be as constant as a river. Although I believe death is not the end and our spirits live on, I am never fully prepared for life to dry up. Devon bows his head and offers our traditional prayer of rest. Gods, bless Brother Sean's soul so that he may find the gate that leads to peace and everlasting light. Yesterday afternoon, I found Brother Sean slumped over in his chair outside the wheelhouse. For the past fortnight, since we fled the city of Eresh, he prayed diligently for the gods to preserve us in this dire time. Inda said his heart merely failed, as aged hearts do. But I think his fear put him in an early grave. Devon finishes by adding his thoughts.
Brother Sean was a dedicated, loyal, and loving member of the Brotherhood. He exemplified the five godly virtues in every way and served Anu with his whole heart.
His ragged voice catches.
He will be missed.
Yatin, his brother in arms, squeezes Devon's shoulder. The soldiers slide the body to the edge of the skiff. Pons helps them push the remains overboard, and the water splashes in finality. Tears sting my eyes. The body floats for a heart-wrenching beat, and then the stones drag Brother Sean below the surface of the murky river. Anki, Inda says, praying to the water goddess. Send your sea dragons to ferry Brother Sean's soul to the beyond, and wash away any memory of pain or anguish from this mortal life. Her burial prayer is unusual to us Tarachandians, who worship the sky god, Anu. Inda's people believe sacred creatures of the deep, sea dragons, ferry their souls to the beyond or the void when they die. In this moment, when we cannot stop to dig a grave for Brother Sean, as is our custom, her words are a much-needed comfort. Pons is the first to leave, going to oversee our navigators, the pole pushers. I should rest my injured leg, but I linger near Devon. The river leads us along, and the place where Brother Sean sank drifts away in our shallow wake. A mangrove forest crowds the riverbanks, thriving in the brackish wetlands between the rainforest and the Sea of Souls. The tree roots, partially submerged in the muddy waters, ascend from the surface like knobby stilts. We are nearly to the river delta. Brother Sean was so close to viewing the sea.
Yatin steps to Natesha's other side. Are you all right, little Lotus?
She runs her hand down his chest. Yes.
Her burly soldier with a thick beard came aboard the skiff very ill.
Inda, the most experienced aquifer aboard, cured Yatin's ailment, and Natesha has finished nursing him back to health. Yatin slimmed down while he was unwell, though he is still the biggest man on board.
We were so concerned about his recovery and my tournament injuries. We neglected to care for Brother Sean.
We all bear the weight of that guilt. Natesha and Yatin take the walkway around the side of the boat. Oshwin has left, having snuck off when no one was watching. He and I have not spoken since Iresh. I spend my time with Devon, and Oshwin avoids us. This was the closest the three of us have been in days.
Inda comes to my side.
Kalinda,
it's time.
Given the solemnness of the morning, I consider canceling our session, but Inda's healing powers are the only reason I can stand right now. Devon has yet to look away from the river. I consoled him the best I could last night, but Brother Sean was his mentor. Some losses leave behind holes that cannot be filled. Accepting Inda's arm, we let Devon mourn in peace. Lying on a cot in the wheelhouse, I feel Inda's powers flow over me like tepid streams of water. She lets go of my temples, her expression tight. My hour-long session has not gone as expected. She cleans her hands in the wash basin. The fresh scents from her healing waters, coconut and white sandalwood, waft off my skin.
Well, I ask.
The bone in your leg has knit back together, and the sword wound on your side has closed to a faint scar. Both injuries were sustained during my duel in the trial tournament, but they are not what concerns us. Before our escape from Iresh, the Voider, the corporeal demon set free from his prison in the Evernight, breathed his poisonous fire down my throat. Despite Inda's efforts to cleanse me, his powers still slink icily through my veins. Not even a pain blocker, Inda's rare ability to suppress hurt for a short time, allays the cold. I close my eyes and search inside myself for the single perfect star in my vision. The ever-burning light is the source of my burner powers, my soul fire. No mortal or Buddha exists without this inner radiance. I locate the star, but its vivid light is hazy. I see a greenness behind my eyelids.
That's from the demon's powers.
Can you get rid of them?
I don't know how, Inda replies, helping me sit up.
In a sense, your soul is frostbitten. If the injured parts were an extremity, I would recommend amputation. But as the damage is internal...
You cannot amputate my soul, I finish with a strained laugh, though I find nothing humorous about my memory of writhing on the ground in agony, tormented by the slow, torturous burn of the demon's cold fire. The initial anguish has abated, but it left dark stains inside me, like tarnished silver. The Voider's powers would have destroyed me if I were not one-quarter demon. All burners descend from Unleal, a bastard son of the land goddess Ki and the demon Kor. I suppose I should appreciate my ancestry. But I am not grateful, not at all. Inda's golden eyes reflect her worry.
I'll find you a more experienced healer in Lestari. In the meantime, save your strength and powers. I have had no need to call upon my burner abilities since I battled the Voider. But what will happen when I need them?
I suspend my concerns. We are nearly to Lestari, the imperial city of the Southern Isles. I can hang on until we arrive tonight. Pushing to my feet, I test my weight on my bad leg. No pain hisses at me. Inda offers me her arm, but I pick up my cane. I'll be all right on my own.
I shuffle out the door, mindful of the gentle sway of the ship. Several stops later, I rest in a sunny patch of deck. The brightness warms my skin, but the inner hoarfrost will not yield.
Does Inda know you're out here alone?
I swivel toward Natasha and link my arm through hers.
I'm not alone. You're here.
Let's walk. She tugs me from the banister and we stroll around the outer deck. Her hips swish, swinging her braid like a pendulum, though not on purpose. Natasha cannot suppress her curves any more than I can change my skinniness. As former rivals in my rank tournament among the Raja's wives and courtesans, for a time we could not stand each other. Natasha and my other competitors fought to gain a better life in this world of men. Only I won the rank tournament. My second victory in Iresh's trial tournament secured my throne as Rani of the Tarachand Empire. I competed against 4 female Buddhas in a series of contests designed to test our powers. My prize is to wed Prince Ashwin as his first wife, his kindred. I respect Ashwin, but marriage to him hardly feels like a reward.
The prince left rather quickly after the burial, Natasha notes.
He's avoiding me.
He's avoiding Devon. Did he tell you about their altercation?
No.
Natasha's lips twist wryly.
Right after we left Iresh, Devon struck Ashwin and nearly threw him overboard.
Gods help me. As captain of the guard, Devon's duty is to protect the prince, but he blames Ashwin for unleashing the voider. The demon came disguised in the physical form of Ashwin's father, and my deceased husband, Raja Tarek. For releasing him, the voider must grant Ashwin his heart's wish, to unseat the Buddha warlord from the turquoise palace in our imperial city of Vani. The demon Raja has set out to do just that. He delivered our people from the awful encampments in Iresh, earning their devotion while preying on their suffering. Our army intends to march with the voider to far-off Vani. The rest of Tarek's wives and his courtesans are trapped there. My friends and fellow sister warriors, held captive by the warlord and his band of rebels. I want to see the Ranis released, but the demon Raja cannot be allowed to overthrow the warlord. If he succeeds, he will be free to inflict terror on our world. I've tried to explain, I say, but Devon won't listen.
Maybe he's right to be angry.
Natasha's gaze wanders to the river. Even Brother Sean feared our fate.
Unfortunately, the loss of Brother Sean is another tragedy for Devon to blame on the prince.
Ashwin couldn't have known that the demon would disguise himself as Tarek and convince our people he's their Raja.
We round the stern of the boat and nearly bump into the prince. He holds an open book, appearing as he did when we first met.
Only this time I do not mistake him for his father. Ashwin may possess Tarek's compelling good looks, but he is kind-hearted. From his wounded expression, he overheard our conversation.
Your Majesty, Natasha says, bowing. We didn't see you there.
Clearly.
He snaps his book shut.
I'll go around.
He starts to pass, but I loop my arm through his.
Walk with me?
Ashwin slowly pivots and rubs the side of his head as though massaging a headache. I tug him forward, and Natasha gladly goes, leaving the other direction.
How have you been? I ask the prince.
Well, thank you.
His perfunctory answer quiets me. The clack of my cane on the wooden deck is the only noise between us. I have nearly given up on a conversation when he asks,
How are you feeling?
Better. Inda said I should be walking on my own soon. He nods, but says no more. I long for the easiness we once had between us. In Iresh, while Devon was imprisoned in the military encampment, Ashwin and I learned to trust each other. I still wear the brass wrist cuff he lent me for good luck before my final trial. Ashwin is my cousin and only living family. Dissolving his friendship is a loss I cannot sustain. I stop, halting him. What can I do to fix this? The awkwardness between us is unbearable.
You know what I want.
He looks everywhere but at me.
I can repeat my wishes if you'd like, but I will keep my word. You won the trial tournament and have no further obligation to me or your throne.
Do you really think I'd abandon you? His brow creases.
I thought, now that Captain Naik has returned...
The Tarachand Empire is my home, too. Our people have been deceived by the Demon Raja. He's marching upon our palace with our army, where my fellow Ranis are held captive by the warlord. I'm with you, Ashwin. Perhaps not the way you hoped, but we'll confront the Demon Raja together. His lips twitch, withholding a smile.
Understood, kindred.
I pull him forward, and he keeps up, relaxing into my side. Where did you find your book? I ask of the text under his other arm.
I stuffed it under my shirt before I left Irish.
My gaze flies to his. You did not.
I did. I saw it on the ground and grabbed it.
Ashwin has read more books than anyone I have met. Is it any good?
Dull as a cow's nose. On the upside, I learned how to sew a turban.
He shows me the title, A Seamstress's Guide to Men's Attire. A laugh erupts out of me. He chuckles quietly, his shoulders shaking. I sober some, questioning the appropriateness of our humor just hours after Brother Sean was laid to rest. But Brother Sean believed all children of Anu, Buddhas and mortals, should dwell in harmony. He would like for Ashwin and me to make amends. We reach the unoccupied bow. Past it, blue sky yawns above the water and mangroves. A breeze tousles Ashwin's short ebony hair. I rest on the wide ridge near the rail, winded from my short jaunt.
Can I escort you back to the wheelhouse?
He asks. I'll stay here a while. Ashwin does not sit, nor does he leave. His indecision about our closeness exasperates me. I have missed him, but the sentiment clings to my tongue. He may interpret my feelings differently than I intend. Thank you for the stroll. He hesitates, all seriousness.
I'm going to regain the Empire, Kalinda.
Ashwin bears the bulk of his transgressions alone. I have seen him pacing the deck at night, kneading away headaches and raking his fingers through his hair. Brother Sean's death only adds to his remorse. Ashwin loves the Empire and his people. He will not rest until he wins them back. I consider his bloodshot eyes. I know you will. He smiles a little and bends down to kiss my cheek. I turn into him. He smells of coconut shaving oil. We both misjudge how close we are, and his lips land on the corner of my mouth. His look of surprise fills my sight. He pauses, and then presses his lips to my cheek properly. His tender mouth lights a fire across my skin. Warmth pierces inside me straight to my core. I lean into him to prolong our connection. For the first time in days, my inner chill thaws, and my soul fire burns true. Ashwin pulls back. Cold rushes inside me again. I gape up at him, speechless. He beams, delighted by my reaction, and saunters away. What has just happened between us? I let him kiss me. Twice. Watching my reflection on the water, I try not to think of Ashwin, but my head keeps reeling. As soon as I reunited with Devon, I set aside my romantic feelings for Ashwin. Yet the prince's kiss could have lasted longer without any protest from me. Is it possible that I still care for him as more than a friend? I cannot ignore those soothing seconds when the winter inside me melted.
There you are, Devon says.
He tugs down his scarlet uniform jacket and sits beside me. Since this morning he has shaved his thick beard and trimmed his hair short beneath his turban. He is prepared to meet the Lestarians, looking every bit a handsome officer of the Imperial Army. I rest against him, nestling into his side, and wait for him to inquire about Ashwin and me. But either Devon did not see us together, or he does not wish to speak of the prince. I do not raise the subject either. Ashwin's kiss was innocent, a gesture between friends, but admitting to one such gesture could lead to questions. Sometimes the truth is more harmful than an omission. And I am not the only one who has kept secrets. Natasha mentioned you tried to throw Ashwin overboard, I say.
It was more of a shove,
Devon replies, taking my statement in stride. I give in to a sigh. You shouldn't have done that. He bristles.
It's my responsibility to defend the Empire. The prince had just unleashed the Voider. By all appearances, he was a threat.
I thread my fingers through his. The prince is your ruler. As soon as he takes a wife, he'll be Raja. I have unintentionally led us into a topic of conversation I have dodged for days. Devon has not asked me to walk away from my throne. He understands my rank as Rani is my godly purpose. And my choice. Or more accurately, an accepted obligation. But neither of us knows where that leaves us, or our dream of a peaceful life in the mountains. You have to put aside your hard feelings. We have enough division plaguing us. He tenses, his voice strained.
I'm trying, Kali. I have a lot on my mind.
More than Brother Sean's passing wears on him. His mother and brother, Mathura and Brock, were stranded at the border between the Empire and the Sultanate. Two gaolers were sent to find them but have yet to return. Each day we wait increases Devon's angst. I cup his smooth cheek. I know you are. He leans into my touch. His features are an appealing mishmash of hard planes and pliable smoothness, like his two main roles, soldier and dedicated worshipper of the Parijan faith. I bring my lips to his. He tugs me closer, and his sandalwood scent fills me up. His body heat skims mine, but does not soak in or alleviate the cold inside me. I disregard whatever that may imply, and trail my fingers up his neck. Hot need builds at the base of my throat, yet the frost within me perseveres. I pull away, breathless and shivering. Devon's soft brown eyes study me.
What's wrong?
I don't know. I should lie down. I use my cane to stand, but Devon sweeps me into his arms. My feet flail out and my hands fly up to his neck. Put me down.
All right,
he says evenly, and then starts for the wheelhouse. I pull the skirt of my petticoat and sari close beneath me. You said you'd put me down.
I will. On your cot.
But I can walk. Devon calls ahead.
Coming through.
A chair blocks our path. Inda and Pons dine on a late breakfast of mashed fruit and currants. Pons's hair hangs down his back. The top and sides of his head are shaved. He grabs Inda's seat and slides her out of our way. I blush at their open stares. The Aquafire and the Gaoler are in love, yet they do not show it with public demonstrations. I sense Pons would if Inda were willing, but she is private about her affections. Devon carries me through the open wheelhouse door and lies down with me, our bodies filling the cot.
See? That wasn't so awful.
I sink against him. I could burn your nose off for that.
You like my nose.
I do, I say, kissing the tip. He slides his rough palm under my blouse and across my bare back. His touch warms me in places Ashwin's kiss could never reach. I press my lips to Devon's again, indulging in the sensation of his body tight against mine. My fingers creep across his muscled shoulders, but his jacket prevents them from meeting skin, constricting my touch. Devon does not stop kissing me while he undoes his front buttons, preparing to take off his jacket. The door swings open and Natasha pulls up short. I'm sorry to interrupt. Her eyes sparkle at finding us entwined. We've reached the river mouth,
A Lestarian ship is waiting.
Devon nuzzles my ear.
Someday I'll have you to myself,
he says in a husky rumble. A warm chill courses down my neck.
I'll hold you to that.
I kiss him once more and sit up. Dizziness whams me from rising too fast, and I sag forward.
You should lie down,
Devon says, rebuttoning his jacket.
I'm fine, just give me a moment.
After a few more breaths, my vision clears. Devon places his hand on my shoulder.
Collie, you really should stay here.
I said I'm fine, I snap.
I know I am weaker than usual.
He need not constantly remind me. Natasha, please hand me my cane. Devon grabs the cane and thrusts it at me. Natasha shrinks away and tiptoes out. Devon is worried about my health, but I have greater concerns.
I have to greet the Lestarians, I explain. Our first impression must reflect well on the Empire.
Inda assured Oshwin and me that we can rely on Datu Bulan, the ruler of the Southern Isles, for aid, but we are placing a lot of faith in a stranger. The Voider is positioned at the head of the most powerful army in the land. We can only hope the Datu will recognize the threat he poses and join us to stop him. I stand and temper my frustration.
I need to go, Devon.
You also need to take care of yourself.
He reaches for a stray hair against my cheek. I swipe it away before he can, and he draws back, hurt.
I'm sorry, I whisper.
Embracing my throne means accepting my responsibility to assist Oshwin.
We need to keep our distance now that—
No need to explain.
Devon adjusts the cuffs of his jacket with short, irritated jerks.
It would reflect poorly on the Empire for the Kindred to favor her guard.
It's only for a little while.
I seek out his understanding, but his expression remains defensive. Oshwin appears at the door.
Kalinda?
He says tentatively, gauging Devon's scowl and oppositional posture.
Inda is asking for us.
I'm coming, I say, leaning into my cane. Even though Devon is upset with me, he hovers close, as though expecting me to topple.
Anu, please don't let my legs give out or I'll never hear the end of it. By God's virtue, I cross the wheelhouse on my own, and Oshwin leads the way.
2. Devon. I grab my sword from behind the wheelhouse door and follow the click-clack of Kali's cane. Since sustaining her injuries, her already tall, lean frame has thinned to frailty. She stoops over like a crane, her healing leg quaking from exertion. Skies, she's stubborn. Helping her would be easier if she would quit interpreting my aid as her failing. She is not weak. She is in need. Before the Voider blasted her with his cold fire, Kali shone bright as the sun and enchanted nature fire into a huge fiery dragon. It hurts to see her struggling. Inda and two more Lestarian aquifiers use their powers to guide our skiff across the choppy delta waters. I manage to avoid seasickness on the smooth-flowing river, but my stomach is less enthused about the open water. On either side of the inlet, the coastline stretches into the distance, dotted with palm trees along alabaster beaches. The rest of my party line up at the rail, staring at the waiting ship. The larger watercraft is more suitable for open seas, with a flat bottom, high bow, and lower stern. I estimate its length at 300 cubits and width about half that size. The exterior has been painted a true blue, and the prow is shaped into the head of a sea dragon. The military vessel has a single mast, but no sails or steering oar. Aquafire sailors, stationed on the starboard and port sides, power the vessel. Hollow barrels are mounted at the stern, water cannons. The Lestarian Navy protects merchant and passenger vessels from the raiders that troll these waters. A serpentine sea dragon, mirroring the prow, decorates the amethyst flag snapping in the wind atop the mast. We reach the Navy vessel and stop before the teak hull inscribed with the name Enki's Heart. Pons throws the line up to the sailors. They fasten it and drop a rope ladder. I climb the ladder first. Two older official-looking men wait to greet us on the pristine deck. The crew consists of men and women, all in baggy, knee-length trousers and tunics. One of the older men, with a long white beard, holds a trident, as I would a staff. He is chewing a wad of something green. Mint? I heard mint chewing is a popular pastime among sailors. The Lestarians watch me with their golden eyes. I leave my sword sheathed, and return their scrutiny. Prince Ashwin arrives next, and then helps Kali off the ladder. I do not react. Pretending her accepting his help does not bother me. But I want to pitch him overboard. I barely restrained myself earlier when I saw him kiss her cheek. A seemingly harmless act, except that he holds the power to force her to wed him. She believes he will not, but I am slow to trust anyone dense enough to release a demon. Yatin and Natesha come aboard next. Natesha leaves her hand free for the dagger at her waist, mistrustful of the strangers. Yatin's daunting gaze and ropey beard cause the strangers to shift nervously, even if he is mild, unless provoked. Pons arrives next, his blowgun wedged in his belt. He is a trained soldier, though his main duty is guarding Inda. He assists her on deck, and the white-bearded man with the trident grabs her up in a hug. "This is my father," Inda says proudly, "Admiral Rimba, head of the Lestarian Navy. Father, this is Prince Ashwin and kindred Kalinda." The admiral bows. "Welcome aboard. This is Ambassador Chit," he says of the nondescript dressed man beside him. "He's the standing Buta emissary." "Please call me Chit," the ambassador says. Gray streaks mix into his otherwise coppery hair. He is tall, about my height, but rangier in build. Cords of lean muscle run up his forearms and disappear under his thin tunic. He may be a diplomat, but his hands and arms belong to a man acquainted with labor. Something about his rugged features is familiar. "Kindred, for a time I was your father's delegate," he says. "I accompanied him on several mediation missions."
"His delegate?"
Kali asks. "Kishan was the previous Buta emissary," the ambassador replies. The breast of Chit's tunic bears the fire god's symbol, a single flame. Admiral Rimba wears the water goddess's emblem, a wave on his collar. Both marks identify them as Butas. I exchange a glance with Yatin. The Sultan employed Butas in his military as well. They did not treat us well.
"I'd like to hear more about my father sometime," Kali says.
Ambassador Chit's presence niggles at my memory as he answers. "It would be my pleasure." Inda picks up where she left off with the introductions, continuing until she ends with me.
"And this is Captain Devon Naik."
"General Naik," Prince Ashwin corrects.
I flinch at my new title of command. After I accosted the prince, I did not think he would honor his word in promoting me to general. And just who am I the general of? We have no army. The only soldier under my command is Yatin, and my friend would follow me anywhere, regardless of my title. If the prince thinks he can persuade me into liking him, he is dimmer than I thought. My father was the army's previous general. Under the Raja's direction, he massacred hundreds of innocent Butas. Inheriting his seat of command is neither a prize nor honor.
"Good to meet you, General Naik," Chit says, examining me as well. "We were told you have another passenger, a member of the Brotherhood."
"He passed away." I cut a glare at the prince. Brother Shan worried himself to death because of him. The thought of the voider let loose in our world was too much for his old heart to handle. I already miss him.
"Has anyone arrived ahead of us?"
Kali asks. Pons has been listening to the wind for messages from my family, but none have arrived.
"Devon was separated from his brother and mother.
They and two Galers, more of our guards, are supposed to meet us in Lestari.
I pray they are already there.
We haven't seen or heard from them, replies Admiral Rimba, squashing my hopes.
He continues, speaking around his mint chewing.
But they could have arrived after we left this morning. We'll soon find out. We must leave now to reach the Isles by sunset.
He and Inda direct us to a cabin at the center of the deck. Pons falls in line behind them, his expression sterner than usual. It is strange not seeing him beside Inda. Prince Ashwin and Kali follow next with Chit, who chats politely about the humid weather. Ahead of me, Natasha whispers to Yatin.
Does the ambassador look familiar to you?
So it isn't just me. I step inside a half second after them and miss Yatin's answer. Benches with pillows line the rectangular cabin, and the doors slide closed to circumvent the wind. Everyone finds a secure place for travel. Of course, Ashwin occupies the seat beside Kali. I sit near the exit, splitting my attention between the foreign navy and my Rani. Sailors shut the sliding doors, leaving the door facing the stern open. The aquifers manning the deck lift Enki's heart on a mountainous swell and fly us forward on a continuous wave. My fingers curl around the edge of the bench. In no time, the ship rocks Kali to sleep. I keep alert, less trusting of our hosts than the others, but my attention wavers as nausea dangles in my belly. Everyone else watches the passing scenery, unbothered by our bumpy speed. Natasha and Yatin point out seabirds and jumping fish to each other. I scan Natasha's hands for the lotus ring Yatin saved for her. When he was ill, he asked me to give it to her on his behalf. I told him to hold on to it. Now that he is well, I thought he would propose. But Natasha is not wearing the ring. Yatin notices my ashen pallor.
Do you need a bucket?
He asks in his gentle burr.
No, just fresh air.
I compose myself and leave the cabin. When I am out of the other's view, I stagger to the rail and retch overboard. Spray shoots up, cooling my cheeks. I empty my stomach and slump over. Past the bow, the sea rolls on with no end in sight. I have never seen anything more empty or dreary. Chit steps on deck and joins me.
General, do you know Mathura Naik?
I gulp down more nausea.
She is my mother. How do you know her?
We met years ago at the palace. She had a little boy with solemn eyes, about this tall.
Chit measures the height of a small child.
He wouldn't fall asleep without his wooden sword.
You spent time in the courtesan's wing, I say flatly.
They only could have met there. My mother was one of Raja Tarek's courtesans.
Mathura was sent to my chamber.
At Chit's use of my mother's first name, I grip the hilt of my sword. We talked all night long about my travels. Her curiosity for the world was infectious. Tarek forced my mother to entertain his men of court and visiting dignitaries.
You never touched her?
I press. Chit's golden eyes flash. Antagonizing a powerful burner may not be my brightest idea.
General Naik, I do believe that's a question for your mother.
I'll be certain to ask her.
I hope you do.
He considers me closer.
I heard Mathura has another son.
My half-brother, Brock.
You mentioned you were separated from your family. Are they in danger?
I don't know.
A frown marks Chit's brow.
When we reach Lestari, I'll do what I can to find them.
Why?
That's another question for Mathura.
The ambassador pats my upper back in an overfamiliar gesture.
You had the same grave stare when you were a boy.
And the same affinity for weapons. He eyes my sword with a snide smile that sends a jolt through me. I gawk after Chit as he returns inside.
I have seen that smirk 1,000 times from someone else. Holy gods. I just met Brock's father.
3. Kalinda. I wake to find I am alone in the cabin. Out the open doors, our party congregates along the bow. Devon braces against the portside rail, wearing a dazed expression. I meet him on deck, achy, but rejuvenated. Are you all right? I ask.
It's been an odd day.
When no one else is looking, I stroke his hand. His distracted mood peels away and he smiles. I want to wrap my arms around him, but propriety must be upheld. Devon points past the bow.
We're here.
The afternoon sun lights up a far-off wall. The towering pile of stones shoots up from the sea, many times higher than our vessel's mast. While squinting, I make out a passageway in the barrier. A low, arched bridge, like a strand of a spider's web, spans the gap. What is it? I ask.
A breaker. Inda said it encircles the whole island. It fortifies against intruders and errant waves.
Devon sounds impressed, as am I. This wall in the middle of the sea is remarkable. A dark line on the northern horizon draws my attention. Admiral Rimba stands on the lookout deck on top of the cabin. I call up to him. What's that behind us? The Admiral swivels around and stares past our stern. The line comes into focus. A tremendous wave advances toward us at an alarming pace. He shouts from above.
Sailors, full ahead! Passengers to the cabin!
Good Anu, Devon breathes. We grip the rail, and Anki's heart races for the island. Seawater mists our face, and the wind blasts my hair behind me. The crew scrambles to the water cannons. The other members of our party and Ambassador Chit make their way down the rail from up deck, hand over hand. Devon and I try to let go of the rail and cross the deck into the cabin, but the ship dips and soars over every roller, and the prow splashes up more surf. Despite our increased haste, the tidal wave continues to gain on us. Natasha gapes at the towering wave. Where in the skies did it come from? Inda pushes her forward. Everyone inside! Devon and I stagger across the deck and into the cabin with them. Out the front window, the protective breaker grows higher and taller. Past the guard bridge, I glimpse the safety of a cove. A shadow falls over the ship. I look out the open door, and the wall of water crashes into us. The cabin's structure holds, but waves rush in and knock us down. I slide across the floor, soaked through in an instant. The water recedes, violent streams of cold that slap and drag at me. Devon crawls to my side, his turban missing. Ashwin lies on his belly, coughing up water, but otherwise unharmed. Natasha and Yatin hold each other in a puddle, while Inda and Pons brace themselves in the corner. At our stern, a ship barrels for us. The three-mast vessel is painted an incongruously cheerful yellow. A dark cloud hangs ominously above the ship, punctuated by lightning. Thunder rumbles, an imminent warning of the vessel's pursuit.
Water cannons port side, shouts Admiral Rimba.
The ship careens alongside us, its size filling the sky and its water cannons aimed to shoot. I wipe water from my eyes and peer up at the vessel's black flag with its white symbol. A large shark with jagged teeth. The Sea Raider's emblem. Our pursuers employ their cannons. Salt water jets in through the doors of the cabin, blasting one off its hinges. Devon crouches over me and absorbs the spray. The targeted streams of water force two of our cannons into the sea and crush another. Several of the crew are swept off deck into the rough waves. The terrible winds bellow and the ship creaks and groans. The raiders lower their biggest cannon at our cabin and blast more water at us. Devon is pushed off me and he slides to the door. Pons grabs his wrist and they are both swept out on deck and dragged to the rail. Pons latches onto a crate, stopping them from falling overboard, but Devon's legs dangle over the edge. I lurch out of the cabin onto the open deck. Harnessing my soul fire, I send a heat wave into the storm. Enough! My flames evaporate the water on my hands, fizzling the drops to steam. A man high up on the opposing deck comes to the rail to see who cast the heat wave. Ambassador Chit flanks me, his hands also glowing.
What do you want, Captain Locke?
Chit calls to the man on the other ship.
We have no interest in you or the Navy, Ambassador.
Captain Locke points at me.
We've come for the Kindred and Prince. Raja Tarak has offered a reward for their return. Prince Oshwin and Kindred Kalinda are under our protection,
Admiral Rimba answers, calling across the watery divide. Though the sea between our ships has started to calm, tension churns in the thundery sky.
I suggest you go before our fleet arrives.
He points to vessels speeding out of the breaker from the island.
Give us the prince and Kindred, and we'll leave,
Captain Locke replies. Behind me, Oshwin is stony, but I read him as well as he does one of his books. I turn to Captain Locke. The prince and I stay. Captain Locke goes on, unruffled.
Kindred, your husband requires your presence.
I throw a warning heat wave at his ship. The voider is not my husband. My fire glances along their bow, scorching a line across the hull. Men dive away from the path of my fury. Captain Locke ducks behind the rail and rises again. An exquisite chill akin to delight empowers me. The raiders fear my abilities. And well they should. But Captain Locke does not direct his crew to retreat. My impatience surges. Go away! Flames fly from my hands high across the water, their centers white and their edges a strange pale green. My heat wave hits the vessel's mast and burns its flag. Captain Locke summons a pillar of water to extinguish the fire and then raises snake-like streams from the sea and aims them at me. I stand ready, bolder with Chit at my side than I would be alone. The Navy vessels race closer, moments away. Should the raiders engage us, they will have to engage their entire fleet. Captain Locke throws his streams of water at the hull. Waves splash the deck, hitting my sandals.
Another day, Kindred.
He signals to his crew and they maneuver their ship farther out in the open water. I hobble across the deck. Devon sits away from the rail near Pons, catching his breath. Those dolts, I say, helping Devon stand. Raja Tarak is dead. Devon squeezes water from his tunic and soaked turban.
I never thought anyone could be more dangerous than Tarak. And then I met the demon impersonating him.
Pons summons a breeze that rushes over us, wicking away the immediate wetness of our clothes. After the wind passes, he says,
The reward for bringing you back must be generous. Captain Locke wouldn't risk attacking a Navy vessel this close to Lestari without incentive.
Devon and I swap a look. Our decision to meet up with the Lestarians has already proven beneficial. I just hope our meeting with the Datu goes well. The other Navy ships arrive and surround us. Admiral Rimba shouts for his crew to retrieve the sailors who were cast overboard. A crewman cleans up the deck, tossing aside debris so the others may more easily work. Devon groans and leans against me, but his complaint is of exhaustion, not of injury.
I'll help so we can be underway,
he says.
The sooner we're on land, the better.
I hold onto him longer than necessary, and then another breath or two after that. He finally pulls back, and I reluctantly return to the cabin to check on the others. Chit intercepts me at the broken sliding door.
I'd like a quick word, Kindred.
Since he is blocking my way, I wait for him to go on.
Have your powers always been that greenish hue?
They're usually the color of a star, but I've been unwell lately.
Perhaps it's of no concern,
Chit answers, though his tone implies otherwise.
Each burner's powers have a unique color. Mine is a deep currant, and your father's was a vibrant tangerine. But I have never seen a burner's fire any shade of green.
I had not thought to compare my fire to another's. Burners are too few for such an opportunity to easily arise. The only other burner I have met and fought alongside is Brock. I wish he was here so I could ask him if the color of my powers is abnormal. Ashwin squeezes past Chit and hooks his arm through mine.
Kalinda should rest, Ambassador.
Of course.
Thank you for your time, Kindred.
Chit bows, his expression no less troubled. Ashwin and I stroll down the deck and rest on an overturned crate. When no sailors are near, he speaks.
The attack was our fault.
His small voice is packed with regret. No one was hurt.
Thank the gods. Do you think we'll be safe in Lestari?
I look to the stone breaker in the distance. Let's pray so. Ashwin scoots closer to move out of the path of a working sailor. I should put another gap between us, but the prince's touch tames the chill prowling inside me. Since the voider tainted me, I carry his malevolent powers like an invisible brand mark. I told him I am nothing like him. I am a Buddha, a half-god, so I must be good. Whatever sickness he put inside me cannot change my heritage. But something is amiss. My powers are different, and not just their color. I feel less in control. Leaning into Ashwin, I watch the sea and try not to think about what lies beneath the surface of my skin. We sail up to the monstrous breaker in a long line of vessels. Seabirds screech above our procession, some of them nested along the craggy cliff. The crew slows our approach, and we wait our turn to slide under the bridge on the low tide. Water cannons are mounted on the span, aimed at the open water. They're larger than the raiders' cannons, I think. They should keep the raiders out. Anki's heart glides up to the opening, next in the fleet to pass through. Soldiers watch us from the guardhouse on the bridge, and then we coast beneath them into the shade. Through the shadows, I make out runes etched into the underside of the arch. What do they say? I ask Ashwin beside me.
Water in our blood, he answers, reading the ancient script.
I saw that line once in a book about Buddhas. All mankind was created in the likeness of the gods. Sky in our lungs, land beneath our feet, fire in our souls, and water in our blood. Ashwin grimaces at the etchings. The last time he read runes, he released the voider. I'm sorry, I say. I didn't think. Before he can reply, we emerge into a sparkling blue cove. A verdant island awaits across the water. The city of Lestari rises from the sea with dignified refinement. A labyrinth of waterways weaves beneath picturesque houses built on platforms and secured to stilts erected upon the beach. Thick columns, endless windows, and wide-open terrace balconies line every level of the staggered structures. Palm trees thrive on patches of white sand. Arching bridges span the azure inlets, connecting the city without disturbing the ebb and flow of the tides. The Pearl Palace, the grand centerpiece of the Southern Isles, extends into the sunset sky with spindly spires glossy as the inside of an oyster. As I watch, residents light torches to illuminate the roads and homes darkening in the failing daylight. Our vessel slips down a main channel toward the heart of the city and past water mills that power textile, paper, and flour mills. The Lestarians use the tides resourcefully, though I suspect they have ongoing aquifer aid. A woman guides one of the water wheels, pushing a stream through the wheel's slats. An outdoor market runs alongside the opposite bank. The sea breeze flutters orange and lime-colored sunshades stretched between lean-tos. Merchants present a spread of enticing goods, from painted pottery to ripe bananas. Fish hang from rafters, drying in the late-day sun as buyers purchase their wares before nightfall. Everyone's clothes and faces are clean. Everything about Lestari is immaculate, like a perfectly round pearl. The waterway pushes us through the open gates of the Pearl Palace, where Anki's heart bumps against a dock. A medium-height old man, dressed all in white, waits there. Several guards, also in white, flank him, The man's gray hair hangs past his shoulders, and a strand of pink shells rings his neck. His deeply tanned, brown skin is sun-worn, like cracked leather. Our party disembarks, and Admiral Rimba leads Ashwin and me to the gray-haired man in white. My bad leg aches. I left my cane on the riverboat to avoid the impression that the kindred of the Tarachand Empire and two-time tournament champion cannot walk without assistance. Admiral Rimba bends into an impressively low bow.
Datu Bulan, we bring you Prince Ashwin and kindred Kalinda.
I have eyes, Admiral,
the Datu answers, quirking a bushy brow at my slouch. He is not a big man. Even stooping, I tower over him.
Welcome to Lestari, jewel of the Southern Isles.
My posture aggravates my sore leg. I speak to hide my discomfort. Thank you for your hospitality. Have any members of our party arrived before us?
So far, only you,
replies the Datu, revealing a gap between his top front teeth. Ashwin stands taller, as he often does when I am at his side.
We're eager to discuss the happenings in Iresh.
The Datu's eyes cool on the young prince. I have only seen Devon look at Ashwin with that much distaste.
We are preparing supper for you and your Viraji. First, let us direct you to your chambers.
I startle at the Datu's formal endearment for me, and at the fringe of my sight, Devon stiffens. No one has called me Viraji, intended queen, since Tarek claimed me as his final Rani. Datu Bulan, I say. There's been a mistake. I'm not... Kalinda isn't well enough to stand here any longer, Inda finishes. She suffered an ordeal while securing her throne in the trial tournament. I must insist she rest. Datu Bulan dons a paternal friendliness.
Then let's move along.
Ashwin pulls back.
Datu, may I have use of your library?
He intends to research the voider. Buddha powers cannot injure the demon, so we have to find another way to stop him. The Datu does not balk at the prince's request, nor does his glower lessen.
As you wish.
Admiral Rimba steps forward.
Pons can escort the prince.
Devon does not object to leaving Ashwin in Pons's care, but Inda raises her voice. Must it be Pons, father? We only just arrived.
The ambassador and I have matters to attend to,
Admiral Rimba clips out.
Have you any grievance, Pons?
Pons tucks his arms in, his chin high.
No, sir.
He speaks to Ashwin.
Your Majesty, if you'll follow me, I'll show you the way to the library.
Ashwin begins to go with him, and the newness of this place lands on me all at once. Will I see you soon? My question arises as a demand. Distance between Ashwin and I has not troubled me before, but the pressure on my chest will not abate.
I'll find your chamber later, Ashwin promises,
and he sets off with Pons. My anxiety dissolves, until I catch Devon's sidelong look. I cannot say what came over me, except that I am not as comfortable in the company of our allies as I thought. Admiral Rimba leaves with Chit, and Datu Bulan shuffles up the main walkway in sandals that are too big for him. An amethyst banner with a sea dragon hangs above the arched entry. Through the main doors, pastel shells encrust the ivory walls and lanterns. Additional banners drape from the vaulted ceilings, splashes of majesty that offset the neutral decor. In the center of the entry hall, a fountain cascades down from the second level between the double staircase. The Datu slows before the fountain's base, so we can view the lifelike sculpture of Anki riding astride a sea dragon. The creature's sleek, serpentine body is half-submerged in the miniature rapids. The goddess holds a trident in one hand, her arms open to the archipelago of the Southern Isles. I recognize the depiction of the legend from my history lessons with the Sisterhood. This scene portrays the creation of the Isles. Datu Bulan smiles, revealing his toothy gap.
Very apt, kindred. We tell our creation story every spring at the highest tide.
Will you tell us? Natasha asks him,
I didn't listen as closely in class as Kalinda. Yautin releases a deep chuckle, and Natasha elbows him to